Hi, I'm James Esposito, and this is New Books in History. I just finished speaking with Norman Ohler about his new book, Blitzed, Drugs in the Third Reich. This book was published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt in 2017. Ohler shows how the Nazi elite embraced methamphetamine as a wonder drug, free of the connotations of the disease and degeneracy associated with the drug culture of the Weimar years. Stimulants became a valuable tool in Germany's wartime arsenal. The German military acknowledged the value of amphetamines and distributed Pervitin en masse. Ohler argues amphetamines allowed the Wehrmacht to defeat the Allies in France and elsewhere during the Blitzkrieg years of 1939 to 1941. These gains were short-lived, however, as Nazi Germany's Faustian bargain with drugs eroded away during the Battle of Stalingrad and in the distant steppes of the Soviet Union. Research for ever more powerful drug combinations were desperately sought to save the Reich from annihilation, exposing the horrors of the regime from experiments on concentration camp prisoners to drug child soldiers. Blitz details how Hitler's personal physician, Dr. Theo Morell, administered vitamin concoctions and hormone injections common to athletic doping. Although Hitler had promised to cleanse the nation of illness and drug abuse, he himself became utterly dependent on drugs to survive. Military defeat and destruction took their toll on Nazism embodied, and Morell increasingly looked towards methamphetamine and oxycodone to keep Hitler awake and alert during the last apocalyptic years of the Reich. It was a pleasure to talk to Norman, and I hope you enjoy the show. Norman, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's good to speak to you.
Okay, so as is sort of typical with new books, I want to ask you, how did you become or decide to become a historian, and why drugs in the Third Reich of all subjects to focus on?
Well, it was rather a coincidence because I'm a born and bred and passionate novelist, so I tend to invent things and make them credible. But this time a friend of mine told me about the drug abuse in Nazi Germany, and he is a history buff and also a drug buff. He's a DJ in a Berlin underground club, so I took his word kind of seriously, and it was a good idea to write my next novel about the drug scene in Nazi Germany. But when I started researching, I found out that the subject would be dealt better with in a nonfiction book. So I kind of started this journey of writing a historical nonfiction book.
Cool, interesting. You mentioned that at the end of the book on how you came up with that idea. That's fascinating. What do you think? Do you think your work as a novelist has affected the book in how you constructed it in any way, or do you think that you approached it, you know, kind of more as like a nonfiction piece? Because the book is amazing in the fact that it's written for like a wide audience. It's not sort of a typical academic monograph, but it has these sort of bits and pieces that you would find in, you know, in any high level academic history book.
Well, my attempt was to research in an academic way write an academic book, but use a style that would please me and would please my audience. So I probably took the ability, my novelist ability in regards to my writing style, in order to make this book readable to as many people as possible. Because in fact, when I decided to go on this journey to write a nonfiction historical book, I started reading a couple of quite successful historical books and by German authors, but also by an English author, and I found them extremely hard to read. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say boring, but because it's not boring, but certainly hard to read, harder to read than I imagined. And I thought it does not necessarily have to be the case. In regards to structure, however, I worked very closely with the German historian Hans Mommsen, who advised me on how to build the certain parts of the book. It has four large parts. And so I think when it came to structuring, I was very much influenced by how a historical nonfiction book should be structured.
Okay. Yeah, no, I thought it was incredibly successful, the way you structured the book.
Thank you.
Just one more biographical thing. Do you think that this subject, writing, there hasn't been a lot of writing in English about drugs in the Third Reich. I mean, there has been a few books, here or there, but there hasn't really been very many dedicated monographs. Do you think that this was like the time to write this, or did it just come out, just haphazardly? Do you think that like we're prepared? There's enough historical distance from the time period for a book like this to come out and us to sort of accept drug abuse in autharitarian societies critically.
I think the book could not have been written much earlier because the historical school or style of dealing with the Third Reich developed over time, developed over the decades, and it would have been weird if it would have started with the drug abuse, because obviously it had to start with different angles. Historians had to examine ways of understanding what happened and why it happened, and I can understand that historians in the 70s, 80s, and maybe even 90s would not focus on drugs because they would focus on different things. They would focus on economy, on ideology, on more quote-unquote serious ways of explanation or of narrative technique. And I think it really did, I think that time was needed, to that distance was needed. I'm a third, in Germany we say third generation. Author, because my parents are second generation, and obviously their parents are first generation, which were the active generation during that time. So maybe the second generation was not able to look at drugs because maybe they, for once, didn't understand really what drugs are, or they might have thought that drugs are not a serious enough angle to explain certain things. But I think the time really is ripe for examining that angle and hopefully also examining using that angle on other topics as well, not just the Third Reich.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, some of my own work, I recently looked at drug prohibition in the United States, and it's amazing. The historiography is all from the last 10 years. I mean, there's things been written before, but, people taking it seriously and taking the cultural history aspect of it is very, very recent. And I think you're right. I think that your book came out at the right time, and it would have been pretty hard to write it the way that you did, at least, 10 years ago, which makes it very fresh and a very interesting read, of course. So let's dive into the book and just sort of talk about, so one of the first things that you talk about is in the book in the 1920s, and you talk about the drug culture of Germany in the 1920s and how that gets associated with sort of social disorder and danger and ill health, but also in the Nazi mind, it gets associated with anti-Semitism. Mm. Can you talk a little bit about that connection and sort of framing the world of the 1920s?
Well, the 1920s witnessed the first democracy on German soil. It was called the Weimar Republic. Germany coming out of a lost First World War was a struggling society. The economy was quite bad. There was a lot of chaos on the street. There were street fights between the extreme left, the communists, and the extreme right, the Nazis. the mainstream democratic establishment was not very strong. Berlin as this big city, the capital, was considered something of a crazy and unrulable town. The policing was not very strong. Experimentation was quite en vogue. Also, experimenting with drugs was quite normal back then. Drugs were not stigmatized. They were not called poisons yet. In German, we have that word Rauschgifte, which the Nazis coined, which means inebriating poisons. In Weimar Republic, they weren't called poisons. They were just called substances. And this Weimar Republic was hated by the Nazis. Goebbels, the main propaganda figure of the Nazi movement, called it the asphalt, does that make sense? The cement society, mm-hmm. the street society.
Mm-hmm.
The Nazis basically didn't like anything that couldn't be put into order, at least that's what they claimed. So that the Weimar Republic, with all its chaotic ways of and different ways of experimenting with how a civil society could function, was being fought against by the Nazi movement. And from early on, they said the Weimar Republic is being dominated by Jews. The Jews at the time, obviously, were still an important part of the German society. So many intellectuals were Jewish. Many academics were Jewish. So the Berlin life, I guess you could say that it was strongly influenced by the German Jewish community. And the Nazis said that this is a bad thing, and they said that these Jewish Germans are bad for the German society, and they connected them quite quickly to drugs. They said there's one propaganda sentence that comes to my mind now, speaking about the nervous Jewish character who's obviously in need of morphine to calm his nervous mindset. So the Nazis quickly combined their fight against drugs with their fight against Jews. So their anti-drug policy, which then later turns into something completely different, which we will speak about later on, is early on connected with their anti-Semitic policy. Both Jews and drugs are poison. Poison that needs to be extracted from the healthy German body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting too, is you mentioned it, when you're talking about the 1920s, you talk about the big, what we call big pharma today, Merck and some of the other German, pharmaceutical companies. And you mentioned this thing that's really interesting, little tidbit, and there's so many great tidbits in this book, some relating to capitalism, some relating to, mentalities regarding drugs. And you mentioned the fact that in Merck used to import lots and lots of opium from China in the 20s. It wasn't as much in the 19th century. It was really in the 20s when this stuff got really big. And then you mentioned the fact that even in the 20s, the Chinese were, bootlegging labels with the Merck logo on it because Merck had the most, pure opium or heroin. And it's interesting in this book, there's this sort of prehistory of big pharma that sort of begins at this time, and it's all relating to intoxicating substances.
Well, this was actually an advice by Hans Moms, the great German historian. He said to me, look at where the German drug producing actually comes from. And I think it starts in the early 19th century when a young chemist called Saturner isolates the alkaloid in the poppy plant, which we now know of as morphine. So he was able to find out that the active ingredient in the poppy plant, the poppy flower, is morphine, and that is kind of the from then on. Before that, opium was being produced in various qualities. Sometimes it was much stronger than other times. But once Saturna was finished with his work, German pharmacies were able to produce a reliable morphine product. And this some of these chemist shops or pharmacies turned then into companies. For example, the Merck company, which is a global player still today, was a pharmacy in Darmstadt, and they started producing reliable pills. So basically the pharmaceutical industry as we know it today, in terms of producing medicines and drugs, originated or comes from Germany. And Germany didn't have the same amount or the same quality of colonies that, for example, France had, or Great Britain had, or Belgium or Holland had, or Portugal or Spain. Germany didn't have that. It wasn't a sea power. So while the other countries could import natural, exotic stimulants from overseas, which were being sought after in a more and more modern society, Germany didn't have that opportunity and had to produce their own stimulants and their own medicines. So it was a rewarding area for the German companies, because Germany always had a big market. So this is how it came about. And we can see this developing all the way into the 20s, when the Germans, after losing the First World War, were very reluctant to sign that part of the Versailles Treaty, which intended to stop or regulate the production of opiates or of cocaine. Merck had the patent for cocaine and was producing the best cocaine in the world using the annual harvest from Peru, which was brought to the Hamburg harbor, completely legal, and then was turned into the famous Merck cocaine.
Yeah, no, that was something I didn't know about, at least the specifics of it. And it is amazing when you read about that, because today, even though many pharmaceutical companies have this sort of sheen of research and development and, you know, ethical and scientific and empirical knowledge, it's really interesting that so it's all based on this sort of initial sort of isolation of intoxicants and you know, it was an interesting, I think, fascinating topic. But to get back to the book, we should talk about the connection between the Third Reich and how methamphetamine becomes the drug of choice for Blitzkrieg and for the society in general.
Well,
please.
Well, it's quite ironic that the Nazis, who started off as one of the first governments in the world to really wage a war on drugs, that during that regime, a new drug evolves, which is methamphetamine, being produced by Berlin company Temmler, being patented on October 31st, 1937, and then flooding the market in 1938 and 39 and 1940 and so on. That during that, while those anti-drug people were ruling Germany, this drug methamphetamine, which we now know of as a highly addictive and quite dangerous drug, becomes a completely legal drug of choice of the German people in their emerging performance society.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned it in the book, is one of the reasons why methamphetamine was selected over benzedrine was because America had the patent on it. I believe it was the Lilly company that had the patent on it, and they had observed the great athletic prowess of the American athletes at the 1936 Olympics, and that was why they decided to go for amphetamines, because they knew it was a performance-enhancing drug very, very early.
Yeah. After the Olympics, where people who were supposed to be racially inferior, according to the Nazi ideology, were actually stronger than the German superhumans and running faster, and there was discussion in Germany. How could that happen? And an easy explanation was that the American athletes were using Benzedrine. In fact, there's no proof that this actually took place. This was a rumor, and I've spoken to quite a few sports historians who have tried to find out whether that really is true, that the American team was on Benzedrine during those Olympics. And so far there's been no document found that actually proves this. But the head of the Temla company, knowing about the rumors, said we have to produce a better amphetamine. We have to make the super amphetamine, which then turned out to be methamphetamine, which actually is a Japanese invention. It was synthesized in Tokyo for the first time quite a few decades earlier, but the Japanese never turned it into a product. And Temla company actually did turn it into a product, which they labeled or called pervitin. And pervitin came onto the market, as I said before, in late 37, and especially 38, it flooded the market.
Mm-hmm.
Each pervitin pill contained 3 milligrams of pure methamphetamine.
Yeah, wow. It's amazing, but it also seems sort of slightly predictable when you think about the modernity and mechanization, a sort of German idealized mechanized army trying to move as fast as possible over France. It becomes sort of linked, you know, taking amphetamines obviously makes the experience of, you know, movement over land much, much more probably exciting. I mean, can you talk about how the link between amphetamine and sort of blitzkrieg and mechanized warfare of the 20th century? Because in this book, it seems to be inextricably linked, those two ideas.
Yes, I mean, first, pervitin was produced by Temla for the civilian population because they thought everyone could use it. Everyone can take something to be more alert on the job, or to be more happy doing the housework, or to be more, to be cleverer in a business meetings, or to hairdressers would use it and cut more hair. I mean, it was basically good for everyone. And then the army discovered it, because there was a professor called Ranke who was responsible for performance enhancement of the German army, and he thought this is good for the civilian population. Not good, but if it works effectively for the civilian population, why wouldn't it work for a soldier? And he conducted tests, and he found out that it, one, reduces fear, and two, reduces the need to sleep. And those two effects seemed highly rewarding in his mind for soldiers. And actually they were, because the strategy against France was very much dependent on the time factor. Germany needed to cross the Ardennes Mountains within 3 days and 3 nights in order to reach the French border city of Sedan. And only if that would have happened in 3 days and 3 nights, the Germans would already be in the would be able to enter, to invade the French heartland, while most of the French and British troops were still positioned in the north of Belgium. So, and the French and the British thought the Germans can never advance that fast through the Ardennes Mountains. They have to stop at night. We'll be there. We'll destroy their advance easy. That they never thought it would be possible for a large army, to move for days and nights without stopping. But methamphetamine distributed in with 35 million dosages, because that was the number that was given out just before the attack, or during those weeks of the attack, enabled the German army to do exactly that. So we shouldn't say that methamphetamine is responsible for the German victory, the surprising German victory, but it certainly plays a key role in that victory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But as you sort of get to in the book, is that these advantages that the drug gives are only they're an illusion, because in the first year or two of the war, methamphetamine is sort of linked with German victory, but then towards the end of the war, it becomes this darker and far more far more unsettling notion that the beginnings with methamphetamine sort of start to move into morphine and heroin abuse. You mentioned that it, not only in the German army, but in Hitler's personal life himself. I mean, towards the end of the book, it seems like Hitler's doctor is propping him up with every kind of drug imaginable. I mean, it's a big part of your book, and I want you to talk about Dr. Morell and this sort of quack science that's going on as well.
Well, we have to distinguish very clearly between the army's use of methamphetamine, which stayed methamphetamine. They didn't use any other drugs on a mass scale except methamphetamine. But later on in the war against Russia, methamphetamine just didn't work anymore. It's a good drug for a short war, but not for a prolonged war. I spoke to a medical officer, a very old gentleman now, who gave out Pervitine still in Stalingrad, and he said he just it just didn't help anymore, because the war against Russia was lasting for over 3 years. So the methamphetamine proved not so successful towards the end of the German war effort. Hitler's drug taking is a completely different chapter, I suppose, or part or aspect of the whole story. And I dedicate the third part of my book to Hitler's incredible drug career. And this is quite surprising, because the Nazi propaganda not only said that all drugs are bad, and the National Socialist German obviously doesn't take any drugs, but is a good fellow that would not take such a bad thing. It especially stressed that fact on Hitler himself. Hitler was always portrayed as that leader, that clean leader who does nothing else than work for his people. And he has no private life. He's not married. He doesn't drink alcohol. He doesn't eat meat. So Hitler was this kind of health leader in a way. And in fact, most of these claims are true until 1941. But the problem starts earlier on in 1936, when Hitler meets a doctor called Theo Morell, a Berlin doctor who specializes in giving vitamin shots and has a good practice here in Berlin, treating celebrities with his vitamin shots. And Hitler also liked these vitamin shots, and he believed that he wouldn't ever get ill again. He would never have a cold. And he appointed Morell as his personal physician, and the two men spent every day together, and Morell gave Hitler 1 to 2 injections a day the first 5 years, truly mostly with these vitamins that kept Hitler healthy and happy. But then in 1941, in the fall, when the war against Russia turns difficult for Germany, Hitler becomes ill for the first time. He has the so-called Russian fever. He's in bed. He can't attend the military briefing. And he says to Morell, "Give me something stronger than vitamins. I have to go. I have to speak to the generals. I can't let them make their own decisions." And Morell gives him for the first time an opiate, Dolantin, and also a hormone injection, kind of a typical doping steroid injection. And it works on Hitler. And Hitler likes that feeling of being sick in bed, not able to move, and getting in a strong injection and being able to get up an hour later and tell his generals what's supposed to be going on. So this is kind of a turning point, and Hitler more and more then asks for stronger injections. He's not happy anymore with just vitamins. And Morel, who still gives Hitler his daily one or two injections, changes what he actually gives Hitler. And this gets more and more severe or intense or insane until from summer 1943 on, he gives more and more opiates intravenously. And in the second half of 1944, when the war really gets into its decisive end phase, Hitler takes so many opiates on a sometimes two-day interval that we have to call this we have to consider that he might that we might be able to call him a junkie in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. In your book, you have some great visual sources where you show Dr. Morel's you know, his memos for patient A, is Hitler is known. Yeah. Every other day, and towards the end of the war, more than that even. And you sort of talk about how, you know, there's been a lot of talk about Hitler having Parkinson's disease at the end of his life, but you say that it's possible that he might have just merely been in withdrawal or in some sort of medicated state that it at least exacerbated these symptoms.
Yeah, I don't think that. I mean, it's obvious that his health deteriorated, and I think it's too easy to just call it Parkinson's because there's no proof that it was actually Parkinson's, but there is proof that he took huge amounts of very hard drugs in a very in a way that cannot be healthy, because he takes very different drugs with very different effects. He mixes them, and Morel had no clue of how these very potent substances that he administered Hitler, over 80 substances that he shot into Hitler's veins, how they would interact. So it's no surprise that Hitler's health really deteriorates towards the end of the war. And we can also see that starting January 1st, 1945, when Hitler moves into that last phase of hiding or living in the bunker in Berlin, in the center of Berlin, suddenly these drugs stop. And that's when heavy withdrawal symptoms have to set in. And if we look at Hitler's physical behavior, the tremor, the way he looks, the way he behaves, I think it's more than likely that he was suffering from cold turkey. Then again, mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that he didn't have Parkinson's. He might have had Parkinson's on top of that. I mean, he was certainly a physical and mental wreck in the end. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting also that Morel's fortunes go with Hitler's fortunes as well. I mean, at a certain point, they become linked as well. You talk about how Morel's wife was very hesitant about getting involved with the top leadership of the Third Reich because she was afraid for his life and she was afraid for her life. And he seemed like he was tempted to, you know, live this grander lifestyle. You talk about at one point where Morel is offered a house in Berlin in a very fashionable neighborhood that he would never have been able to afford if he had just been a regular doctor.
Yeah, Morel was a typical opportunist in a way, or, I mean, maybe it's even understandable how he reacted, because when he was offered the job in 1936 by Hitler to become personal physician, this was like a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I mean, Hitler was revered by the German people. There was no war yet. He was a very powerful leader. And so for Morel, it was a huge career jump. His wife said, "We don't need that. You have a good doctor's office here in Berlin. Why do you do that? We won't spend much time together anymore," which was true, because Hitler really tied Morel onto him. They became like a symbiotic pair. And in fact, there's no one that spent more time with Hitler than Morell, which is another fact that historians have overlooked because they have, in a way, also overlooked Morell for all this time. And Morell had this tremendous impact on Hitler because they spent every day together and they exchanged. They had quite an intense exchange through these syringes, through these injections.
Mm-hmm.
So Morell really is a fascinating, absolutely fascinating character that gives us a very interesting look at the inner rooms of this regime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting too that as the Third Reich waxes, Morell's own pharmaceutical and medical empire sort of waxes as well. You talk about how Morell needed for his hormone injections, he needed like basically access to animal parts. Like he takes over like a American-built slaughterhouse in the Ukraine, and he needs it to take all these bits of animal organs or whatever to get hormones and stuff. And it's a very ghoulish aspect to it as well. To make this sort of quack medicine work, he needs these bodies, which I thought was very very disturbing.
Yeah, this is a chapter that's called Slaughterhouse Ukraine, and I think it's one of the darkest chapters in the book. But it's also a very interesting one because we can really see how Morell thrives in his position and how he uses his position as the personal physician of the so-called Führer to attain the monopoly on all the slaughtered animals in all of the abattoirs in the Ukraine, taking all the organs, the valuable organs of these slaughtered animals out and ship them in army trains back to his factory in occupied Czechoslovakia, where he then produces his hormone concoctions, his liver juice that was then supplied to the German army. And I mean, he became quite a rich man, which was always his goal. I mean, he looked around and he saw that everyone being close to Hitler really profits from this regime and really gets rich and powerful. So he wanted to do the same, and he found a way by constructing this kind of one-man pharmaceutical empire. It's quite a crazy and fascinating story, actually.
Mm, yeah, no, it's one of the more interesting aspects of the book, for sure. If switching gears for a moment, like there's so many good little bits in this book I really enjoyed. From the visual sources in the book are fantastic. There are so many ones that are amazing, and one of the ones that is almost most haunting is the Pervitin chocolate. So there's this I forget what page it's on, but there's a photograph of a German woman getting chocolates from, you know, her lover or her children or whatever, and they're just filled with methamphetamine. And it's interesting. It hits the gender aspect as well, the sort of gendered aspect of you know, a woman's role, but also it is, there's something like they all seem so okay with it, you know, or at least the marketing seems like very okay with it. How did you end up like putting the visual sources you decided into the book itself? Because you picked so many great ones. We're actually sort of fortunate that there are so many visual sources in the text.
Well, I mean, I did a very long research, and I found many interesting visual pieces. For example, that ad for that Hildebrand chocolate—that was the brand name. The slogan was Hildebrand chocolate's always a delight. And I mean, just from that picture you see from that German Fräulein holding in her manicured fingers a piece of chocolate which is laced with 13 milligrams of methamphetamine, it just tells a lot, and it just gives you a sense of how normal it was to use methamphetamine in that society. So I think for me it was very important to include those images, and the book's being translated currently into 26 languages. And unfortunately, some foreign editions have decided not to reprint those visuals. But Blitz, the American version, does show all the visual material that I've selected, and I think it really adds to the book. And so I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it does. I felt that we're fortunate to have so many rich visual sources. Just getting towards the end of the book, I want to get this on here as well. You talk about the use of child soldiers and the Kriegsmarine, and you mention two really interesting things. That the Kriegsmarine's hands were not completely clean, which is, a semi-mythologized history about the German Navy, but also the fact that the Germans used child soldiers. And in I think in our minds, in our contemporary world, we sort of confine child soldiers as maybe something to the distant past or some remote part of Asia or Africa or some insurgency or something. But there's a point in this book where the Kriegsmarine decide it's a good idea to pump these children full of methamphetamine and then send them out on suicide submarines. Can you talk a little bit about that chapter and how you get the research for that done and how that worked?
The sea battle against the West was basically lost for the German Navy. All their big submarines had been sunk, and so the last straw of hope for them was to construct mini submarines, which would be driven by one or two soldiers, and the idea was that they would approach the big British and American ships unseen, undetected by radar, and then send the torpedo and sink them. But in order to do that, these mini submarines had to be in action for that was calculated about 5 days and five nights without stopping, and since often they were only manned by one person, it was considered impossible for anyone to stay awake that long, and if you fell asleep in those things you might drown, or it wasn't possible it just didn't work if you would sleep. So they were looking for drugs that would keep these very young soldiers awake for this long time, and pervitine only worked for 2 days and two nights. That was kind of the average where it would keep you awake. So they were looking for new drugs, actually. They were looking for a wonder drug. They were testing different drug combinations. They would make pills laced with cocaine, methamphetamine, and Oikodal, Hitler's favorite opiate. Put all of these three together to form a drug which was called D9, drug 9. That was the most potent of all. But then they found that these young soldiers went completely mad when they took these strong drugs and then were alone riding through the depth of the ocean. It just shows you how desperate the German war effort in the end had become, because this is a development of 1944 and 1945. And a very dark and aspect of that hunt for the wonder drug was that the Navy hired a group of prisoners of the concentration camp of Sachsenhausen, which is the concentration camp north of Berlin. They basically paid the SS that they could use these prisoners in that concentration camp, a group of prisoners, to test their new drug combinations and in order to find out which is the most potent of these new types of wonder drugs they were trying to develop. So the Navy, which after the war always said, we were not really the bad guys, the SS was bad, but we had our clean uniforms, we were just fighting in the oceans. This was a different... It's kind of a myth that the German Navy was the only army part that didn't commit war crimes. I discover in Blitz that is certainly not true, because they actually abused concentration camp inmates in order to test their new drug combinations for their insane missions to turn the war effort in the seas around. And this is an important part of Blitz, and I researched this together with an expert from the current German army who's an expert on that specific topic, and I studied the archives in the concentration camp of Sachsenhausen, where all this material is still being present and archived. And when I presented that to Hans Mommsen, the leading German historian on National Socialism, who basically knows everything about National Socialism, he said he's never heard of this before. So we can see that even historians who are knowledgeable, who should be knowledgeable about all aspects, are absolutely not knowledgeable about all aspects, because it's simply impossible to know everything. And so also this chapter of very sinister drug abuse by the German Navy in a concentration camp close to Berlin had not properly been exposed or examined before.
Mm-hmm. Just one more thing I want to talk about is ersatz and the fact that, and you mentioned this in the book, that methadone, which is, as we know, commonly prescribed for those addicted to heroin in the United States and Europe, I presume, as well, was developed by IG Farben as a substitute for morphine, because they were afraid that they would run out of morphine for pain control for injured soldiers. Can you talk a little bit about how you found that out? Because I thought that was a really interesting part of the book as well.
Well, there was a point in the war where Germany was cut off from the opium fields of Morocco, but especially also of Afghanistan, and Göring being a morphine addict himself, was afraid that there would be a time when there wouldn't be enough natural morphine available. So he was initiating this project to develop a completely synthesized painkiller, which actually was developed. It was somehow too late in the war effort to mass produce it, and then which is the methadone that we know today. And then when America invaded Nazi Germany, they took that patent as a war booty, and then were able to mass produce methadone as we know it today.
Interesting. Norman, what are you working on now? Are you working on another history, or are you going back to writing novels, or what are you doing now?
Well, right after I finished Blitzed, I took up a project, a novel that I started 10 years ago, which is set in the 18th century. In a huge swamp area east of Berlin, where King Frederick the Great decides to drain that very swamp and turn it into farmland. So this is a historical novel, a murder mystery, because in fact the most important engineer of that project died of mysterious causes. And in my novel, I examine through a detective, an early form of a detective, why this man got killed. And so it's about resistance against this land reform project of King Frederick. It's a very different project, but still meticulously researched, I would say. I would hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
no,
it comes out actually in the fall in Germany under the title of The Equation of Life, and hopefully then will also come out in other languages, hopefully 2018.
Okay, Norman. Well, I think we've taken a little enough of your time up.
No problem.
Thanks for talking with me.
Well, it was a pleasure talking to you. I'm very happy to speak about Blitz with you.